Yeah, I guess some of us who recognize the score, some of us, like me, have shed a lot of tears on it, tears of pain. Some remember it more fondly, perhaps Katrin Zurek, but I don't see her here yet. Anyways, so the sort of model-independent landscape of dark matter masses, as we know, is very vast, and it's really bounded by two considerations on either end. On the low mass end, you've got quantum effects. That means that the Compton wavelength of a particle that is too light becomes macroscopic and starts to interfere with the size of collapsed structures that we do observe in the universe. And on the other end, we have very massive dark matter candidates that act like gigantic bullets that pierce through beautifully stable structures that are observed in the universe in ways that would disrupt them. In this vast landscape, we had for many years a love story with one particular corner, and we spent many, many millions of dollars looking for dark matter right there. Now, if you put this in perspective, it kind of looks depressing a little bit. But you know, many of us didn't really take seriously this end of the spectrum up until when this happened, and then you know, we started taking things a little more seriously. Then you know, people started writing papers that you know, enhanced the interest in that end of the mass spectrum of dark matter. And so at some point, we had to contradict authoritative sources like XKCD that claim that black holes are ruled out. And so what I'm going to talk about today is why I think it's interesting to go back and consider that end of the spectrum seriously as dark matter candidates, and where within that vast, still very vast landscape of masses, I think it's interesting to look for PPH's dark matter. And then I'll also comment on these other candidates here that XKCD calls the no-see-ums and the space cows. All right, so I'll start here. As Alex explained in his brilliant talk yesterday, this plot is wrong. But that was kind of the starting point when my students started knocking on my door, and they all wanted to work on PPH's dark matter. And so the first question that I asked them is, okay, fine, you know, this plot, as Alex explained, is obtained by assuming that all the PPH, all these, you know, black holes have the same mass, kind of a monochromatic mass function assumption. But, you know, that doesn't really tell you how much total dark matter can be in PPH, because if you relax that assumption, then things start to change. And so what I asked them was, okay, let's just sit down and find the optimal mass function for a given set of constraints, whatever you decide they are, whatever Alex tells you they are. Go out and tell me what is the maximum amount of dark matter that could be in PPH. And so, as Tommy and others said, carried out, you know, if you assume different mass functions, the constraints you have vary. But it is a well-defined question to say, all right, you have complete freedom, functional freedom, to choose your mass function. What is the mass function? An integrated over all masses gives you the maximum amount of dark matter compatible with a set of constraints. And so I'm very lucky because I have this very smart guy who came to Santa Cruz with a master's in math from Stanford, and he realized that this problem is actually equivalent to an interesting mathematical question, which is minimizing the norm of a vector over a convex hull. And so thank God he knew about that theorem. And so what he did was he rephrased this problem, which, you know, naively you might think is a variational problem, but it's not, because the mass function is positive definite, so it's a lot more subtle than just a variational problem. And so the answer is that if you have n independent constraints, your optimal mass function is a linear combination of n distinct delta functions with calculable weight. All right, and so if you have, you know, this set of constraints, which again are wrong, you can calculate where you can optimally place delta functions in such a way that you get the maximum possible amount of dark matter out of it. So it's great to have smart graduate students, but I generally don't believe them. And so what I did, I took another graduate student and I told him, okay, go check if what Ben has done is right. And so he wrote a simple code that, you know, carried out this optimization problem numerically, and it's pretty remarkable because Ben got it right, and so that was the right answer. And so again, you know, whatever set of constraints Alex Kuzenko gives me, I can give him the optimum, the absolute upper limit to the amount of mass in PBH. And if you look at these constraints, you know, it's a non-trivial question because, again, this is the fraction of PBH that can be the dark matter, and you might trivially conclude that it never goes to one. But in fact, if you pick the right mass function, you can get to one. Now, of course, this... Absolutely, absolutely.
If you believe into something like supersymmetry, then you'll have 100 candidate fields competing for the role of a black hole producer.
Right. So you know, we didn't get into there, but it is not an insane mass function. I completely agree with you.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And you can imagine, you know, inflatron profiles to do that as well. So that's great. You know, for somebody like me who spent most of their career thinking about how to detect dark matter, I think PBH is very interesting because there definitely is a Goldilocks signal or signature of PBH, which is to observe a black hole merger where one of the two objects is sub-Chernozemsky. Okay, and this was already mentioned again in Alex's talk. And thanks to Sarah here, we now have officially a LIGO search that a search for this sub-Chernozemsky mass PBH. And let me just advertise this beautiful paper. The author list is also really cool. There's this infinite list of LIGO scientific collaboration names and then Sarah's name. So thank you, Sarah. Okay, so but again, you know, you might ask, all right, how large can the merger rate of sub-Chernozemsky mass PBH B, you know, if you again have complete freedom on the mass function. And so I grabbed Ben again, my smart Stanford math guy, and I asked him, okay, let us now calculate, let us now maximize, instead of the mass function, the merger rate. So given, you know, a mass function psi, I can calculate the merger rate you know, by just having some sort of functional form for the merger rate dependence on masses. But I want to do that while at the same time having some of this PBH be sub-Chernozemsky mass. Okay, so my figure of merit is going to be the mass fraction of light and detectable black holes. In other words, black holes that are below Chernozemsky, but the LIGO might see in a black hole merger. Okay, so that's, for me, the x-axis of this plot. The y-axis is, again, the fraction of PBH's dark matter. And so you can play both games. You can find the minimum and the maximum rate of these Goldilocks events at LIGO. Okay, so once again, this is the fraction of PBH in mass. Okay, which fraction of the mass in PBH is light and detectable, so sub-Chernozemsky mass and visible by LIGO, and the y-axis is the fraction of PBH that are dark matter. Okay, so the contour lines indicate the rate of these events at LIGO per year that is maximal. So complete freedom on the mass function, what's the maximal possible event rate? And it already violates, you know, constraints, for example, on the unresolved stochastic gravity wave background. But the good news is that advanced LIGO, in the most optimistic possible case, can be sensitive to these Goldilocks events, even if, you know, PBH are as small a fraction as, you know, 0.01% or so. Richard, you get a question? Yeah, so we have a couple of different functional forms that we utilize to calculate the formation rate of binaries. So usually what you really like are mass functions where you have a lot of very light guys, and then some guys that are, you know, in the Goldilocks range, and then some massive guys so that the event is visible. Okay, so, but let me get there in just a couple of slides. So you can do this maximum merger rate. You can also do the vice versa. So you can look at the minimal guaranteed merger rate of Goldilocks events. And that's pretty cool, because for sure, you can go lower than that. Yes?
The input here is the mass functions you're sharing
yes.
between the sides.
Yes. And so you're marginalizing over that.
Sure. And then so you're taking, this is the new one, the not wrong constraints, right?
Yes. This is with the good constraints. Okay. Yes, 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 yes. The convolution of the two. Exactly. 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 And so, you know, this is kind of depressing because, you know, the bottom of the merger rate is quite low. But if you have enough black holes that live, you know, that contribute to this light and detectable fraction of guys, then you do have, you know, a pretty interesting merger rate level, but only in this very far end. So to just give you guys an example of mass functions that I like, again, usually you want some very, very light guys to form a lot of binaries, and then, of course, you want some guys that are in the light and detectable range, and then some more massive guys to make the event louder. And again, you just numerically marginalize on these mass functions. And this is preliminary, but it's coming out soon. So besides the mass LIGO, of course, tells us about the spin. And so that's something that we had some fun with Nico Fernandez here, that Jesse knows as well. So this is the first time that Nico saw snow. Nico is from Colombia, and he recently moved to Illinois from Santa Cruz. But I'm hearing that he's fine. He's surviving the snow there. So Nico's a really smart guy. And what he was wondering about is, how can we use the effective spin to tell about the origin of black holes that are observed by LIGO. And so the idea is, of course, the effective spin is, you know, this sort of complicated projection of a mass-weighted intrinsic spin over the, you know, orbital angular momentum of the binary. And so you can have large effective spins if your spins are aligned, which is sort of what you expect if these two black holes come from stellar binaries. Or anti-aligned, you know, would give you an effective spin close to zero, but you would also get an effective spin close to zero if the intrinsic spin of the merging black holes is low, of course. And then, of course, there's the last possibility that the effective spin is close to negative one, but that's pretty unlikely. So what we did was, okay, let's assume that, you know, there exists some knowledge, which there isn't, about what the intrinsic spin distribution of black holes should be. And, you know, for PBH, you can make some predictions depending on when they form. So if they form in radiation domination, they tend to have pretty low intrinsic spins. And then you can say, okay, I don't know what the intrinsic spin distribution is, and so I can say low, high, or flat as proxies of different shapes for the intrinsic spin distribution. And then, of course, the other thing that you can play with is whether the intrinsic spins tend to be aligned or isotropically distributed. And so what Nico did was he calculated the prior probability distribution for combinations of intrinsic spin distributions and alignments. Okay, and what we decided was that the low and isotropic distribution, which is this curve here, was kind of our benchmark. Okay, that we wanted to measure the actual probability distributions that LIGO was giving us against. And so we did this exercise. So these are the actual posterior distributions event by event of 10 of the 10 of the first 10 LIGO events, okay, as compared with our prior. So what you can do is you can calculate odds ratios. So you can weigh, you know, how well your prior compares to the actual data versus your benchmark case. And it turns out that PBH actually have a positive odd ratio, which means that they're statistically marginally favored for the first 10 LIGO events compared to the low and isotropic, so I want to believe. But of course, the question is, what's going to happen when LIGO dumps a bunch more events? How will this odds ratio evolve? And so if the truth is PBH, then what we're going to see is we're going to see, you know, for example, low and isotropic decline and, you know, the significance with which you can distinguish the different prior distribution is going to, you know, eventually increase 2, 3, 4 sigma with number of events in the hundreds, okay? And of course, you can do this for a variety of different combinations, low isotropic, flat isotropic, and so on. But, you know, likelihood is that maybe a fraction of these black holes that LIGO has observed are of primordial origin. So what if we've got a mixed situation where a fraction of these black holes are primordial, say a fraction F of them is primordial, and the rest you know, correspond to one of the other cases. Then you can again build a probability distribution based purely on spin that tells you what the likely, the most likely fraction of PBH versus other stuff is, and you can ask the question, okay, how will this probability evolve as I increase the statistics? Okay, and here you see that, for example, here, you know, we projected for a 50% fraction. There seems to be a systematic, you know, predilection for a larger PBH fraction than true, but eventually you saturate to the real value, which in this case was 0.5. So, but the truth of the matter is that these, you know, black holes measured by LIGO tend to have pretty low intrinsic spins, or, you know, that's what the effective spin distribution looks like. So with my postdoc and again with Nico, we asked the question, well, maybe there's some mechanism by which these black holes can actually get rid of their spin, of their intrinsic spin. And one known mechanism that has been discussed for years is super radiance. Okay, so maybe there's a very light, there's a very light scalar particle that a black hole can use to shed angular momentum. Okay, so that's a well-known mechanism. And so what we set out to do was, okay, so let's assume an initial distribution of spins and alignments. Once we fix that, we can build a probability distribution, a posterior distribution for the best fitting light axion-like particle mass that allows me to go to the level of low spins that I'm observing. Does that make sense? And so that's what we did. That's what primarily these two guys did. Again, this is Nico in a more, you know, Colombian-like weather, and this is Akshay Galsazi. So what you have is essentially you carve out for a given value of the light bosonic mass, you carve out on the plot, on the plane of the mass of the black hole and the spin of the black hole, the intrinsic spin of the black hole, you carve out portions of the parameter space where you cannot have that combination of spin and mass. Okay, so for example, here for 10 to the negative 11 EV, you cannot live above this red line and so on. And then you plot, you know, you superimpose where the actual measurements of mass and spin are, and you draw your conclusions, you know, and you say, well, the mass that does the best to explain where the spins and masses are is blah. Yes.
Is there any comment on the error bars?
Well, no, not really. I mean, that's what LIGO is giving us. You know, that's what LIGO is giving us at this moment. So I don't have any comments about the error bars. I worked really hard to convince Akshay and Nico that this is not Reggie by Regge, but anyways. So the problem is that we know of very large spin binaries, X-ray binaries tend to have very large spins. So how does this jibe with the fact that X-ray binaries have large spins? How does it work? Well, we don't really know, but a cool thing is that you don't shed spin immediately. It actually takes time for the process of super radiance to shed the intrinsic spin of the black hole. And so for some time, you know, the system is in an L equals one state, then in an L equals two state. And so you can wonder, well, maybe the X-ray binaries are just young enough that they haven't made it yet to the low spin that eventually they will reach by virtue of super radiance. And it's kind of interesting that for some masses, we did observe that, you know, some of these X-ray binaries seem to lie on the lines corresponding to, you know, different angular momentum, and so that's pretty suggestive, and so that might be an explanation of why these X-ray binaries, you know, relatively young systems, they can have in this context a large angular momentum. So again, I want to believe. And this is the posterior probability that you get under different assumption for your initial spin and alignment distribution. Okay, so Alex has already commented on the fact that this plot is wrong, and he explained why, in particular, the neutron star constraints are wrong. And his argument was primarily along the lines that, well, people were using systems where there actually aren't any neutron stars, or systems where there are neutron stars, but there's no dark matter, or vice versa. I think some of these constraints were also due to an overestimate of the capture rate in neutron stars by PBH. And so Adrian and I remember when Chris Hirata was a young graduate student at Caltech. He's a very smart guy. So he writes in one of his papers on the topic that he redid the calculation and that indeed these are vast overestimates of the capture rate. So I'm going to believe Chris. And so those neutron star constraints are almost certainly incorrect. So again, Alex already commented on the HSC and the Subaru Andromeda observations. So this is the version one of their plot. And again, there is one candidate that Alex commented on. The version two included what Alex alluded to as the wave effect, so the notion that they're using wavelength that is actually longer than the size of the Schwarzschild radius of the black holes they want to constrain. And so you just have classical diffraction effects there that impede any lensing. The wacky constraints on white dwarfs and neutron stars have disappeared in the meantime in version 2. And then in version 3, they do include the wave effect and they include the finite size source effect, but they assume that all the stars have a very small radius, so the solar radius. Okay, and so...
Thank you.
So this other constraint, also non-existing. Thank you, Alex, for anticipating my next animation. All right, so, and for the same reason. So the femtolensing constraints, they use GRB emission regions, and it turns out a finite size source effects for that case and that wavelength are also as large as to drive these constraints way up here and make them totally irrelevant. Okay, so what we asked was, well, are these constraints, the Subaru constraints on microlensing robust? Well, we were worried about a few things. One of them was that all stars are at the same distance. So they take an average distance to Andromeda, they put all the stars there. That's not quite right, because Andromeda is far away, but not that far away, and it's a big system. It's large in the sky, it's bigger than the moon. All stars are assumed to have the same size, and they assume that the dark matter is completely smooth, that if you tell, people like Jeff, he's like, no, certainly not the case. But with Nolan, who's a beginning graduate student at Santa Cruz, we focused on the problem of the stellar size, and we realized that, in fact, bright enough stars such that Subaru could see any microlensing effect were much bigger than the sun. Okay, the sun is too dim to be able to detect any large enough microlensing effect from there. But the problem is, if the star is bigger and bigger, then the finite size source effects are, of course, more and more important. And the idea, again, is that you're lensing stuff that, you're lensing over angles that are much smaller than your source. And so you're just lensing light from the source, which means you don't get any enhancement. Okay, and so this plot took a long time because what Nolan did was he carefully studied stellar population models that were applicable to Andromeda, and he folded that with the performance of the HSC camera to obtain the distribution in size of the stars that were actually contributing to the microlensing constraints that they were doing. Okay, so that was a cool study. And the bottom line is that there's a lot of real estate that is now no longer constrained by microlensing. Okay, if you look at the scale here, this is more than two orders of magnitude. Okay, so realizing the importance of this constraint was actually a big deal. And so then this begs the question, how do you go after these asteroid-sized black holes? And we heard some ideas in Jeff's talk, but I think we need to go perhaps beyond that. We need a series of different approaches to look for these light asteroid-sized black holes. Okay, very good. So now I want to talk about the space cows. Okay, space cows. So if PBH are too light, they are gone. They evaporate. But the good news is that they might evaporate into interesting things. They might do something good for us. For example, they can evaporate to dark matter. Or they can evaporate to things that then decay and produce the Baryon asymmetry. Okay, so in this study here with two other graduate students in Santa Cruz, Logan Morrison and Yan Yu, we we decided to look for a process where you generate dark matter and ordinary matter, so you produce a baryon asymmetry from the evaporation of black holes. And so I have this Greek-American graduate student who had nothing to do with this paper but suggesting this title. So Evangelos, I don't know if this makes any sense in Greek. Probably not. Not much. Okay. So John might not be very good with his, you know, language of origin, but he's very good at something else, which is Rubik's Cube. So this guy is amazing. So his personal record is 8 seconds to solve a Rubik's Cube. Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty remarkable. Anyways, he's working on artificial intelligence and many other cool things, but yeah, probably not very good at Greek, but it doesn't matter. So, yes, yes. 1.55. That's pretty good, too. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Yeah, yeah. Yep. Okay. But perhaps a 5 by 5 by 5 is even more impressive. I mean, it's 2 minutes, but see, it's a 5 by 5 by 5. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's... All right, so what are the masses of interest here? Well, you want to have light enough black holes that you don't mess up things like BBN or the CMB, but you also don't want to produce dark matter too hot, so you maybe don't want the black holes to be too light. So there's some sweet spot, and so the phase space in this game is the relative initial abundance of black holes when they were born, so when, you know, their Schwarzschild radius was the Hubble radius at the time, and you have a bunch of different constraints that I'm not going to go through. The one thing I want you to notice is that what really controls where you want to live on this plane is the number of degrees of freedom in the dark sector, right? Because black holes don't care where they evaporate to. You just have to be able to evaporate into light enough particles, so particles that weigh less than their Hawking temperature. So, for example, the green line is a dark sector with 100 degrees of freedom, and so you evaporate a lot more into the dark sector, and so you need fewer black holes, and so on.
Are you going to say more about the baryon asymmetry?
So the baryon asymmetry here, we're kind of being very lazy. Okay, you're being very lazy. And what that means is that we just imagine that you evaporate into right-handed neutrinos, that then, you know, through leptogenesis. And so you do have a few constraints. So, for example, you don't want the right-handed neutrinos to thermalize. And also, you want the right-handed neutrinos to be produced before you break the electroweak symmetry. Otherwise, patterns are gone, and so it doesn't work. But given those constraints, this, for a given mass of the right-handed neutrinos, are regions where you produce both baryogenesis through leptogenesis and the dark matter. So you've got these sweet spots right there. So then, you know, we were overly ambitious and we said, well, maybe miraculously evaporation stops. You know, near the Planck scale, there's some weird quantum gravity effect that shuts down evaporation. And so you're left with the dark matter you produce from evaporation, and then once the black holes get as light as the Planck scale, they stop evaporating, but they're still there, and so they contribute as additional relics. Okay, so you have a dual population of Planck relics and the evaporated dark matter that you produce from these same black holes that are evaporating. And again, you can do baryon asymmetry.
Can you do it with Dirac? I mean, if you have Dirac right-handed neutrinos,
yeah,
then you don't worry about the mass.
Well, you still have to produce them somehow, all right? So, yeah. So that's one way to produce them, to get them on stage. All right. So speaking of Planck relics, you know, what we realized is that as evaporation proceeds, there's no reason why these, you know, Planck relics, if then evaporation stops, are neutral. Okay, in general, you evaporate into stuff that has an electric charge, and chances are that in the process of emitting charged particles, you charge your black hole. In fact, this is a very well-known thing, and you know, there were estimates dating back from 1977 that, you know, the claim that the majority of relics, you know, if evaporation stops, should be charged. Okay, and so we looked at that in a little greater detail. We did things a little more accurately, which is quite interesting, but I'm not going to get into. The point is, you know, if for whatever reason primordial black holes evaporate and evaporation stops at some point, then chances are we're left with a population that, on average, carries some electric charge. So can we find these black holes? And the answer, which again is due to this guy, I was telling yesterday to Pearl. So this is an amazing guy. I would really, you know, want him to move on to a fantastic postdoctoral career, but he doesn't want to, because his wife has a fantastic job in Silicon Valley, so he wants to be a graduate student at Santa Cruz forever. But, you know, if he ever decides to graduate, I'll let you guys know, because he's really good. So anyway, the bottom line is you have, you know, Planck scale relics, and a fraction of this carry a charge, whatever fraction you want. This is the plot that tells you how well you can search for these relics using different things. Okay, using things like, you know, the Icarus experiment, direct detection experiments, but it turns out that you can do much, much better with rocks. Okay, so you get two things that you can use when you have, you know, very heavy relics that therefore have very low fluxes. You can either build very large experiments, or you can run experiments for very long times. Okay, and these paleo detectors are based on the idea that, you know, if you have very pure crystals and they can only be disrupted by these exotic, you know, passages of super heavy, super ionizing charged particles, then you can use those crystals and the lack of their imperfections to search for these charged relics. And by far, this seems to be the best avenue to search for these charged Planck scale relics. Okay, so let me actually wrap up. I didn't talk much about stellar mass black holes with respect to how much of a fraction they can be of the dark matter, but we are working on that. And, you know, as you know, there the name of the game is accretion at or after CMB. So that's a complicated thing to study, you know, how the plasma around and after recombination accretes onto these small black holes of stellar size mass. So what we're doing with Massimo Gasperi is we're trying to use CCA models and the idea of self-similarity of accretion. So, you know, there's some ideas of how accretion works in supermassive black holes. And this sort of carries over several orders of magnitude in mass for supermassive black holes. So if you close your eyes for a second, you can imagine that you can extrapolate from 10 to the 9 solar masses all the way down to 1. And you saw the same formalism of CCA theory that you know, could inform you on what happens you know, for the plasma in the early universe. So that's what we're trying to do there, and we'll see which you know, which fraction of the dark matter these primordial stellar-sized black holes could possibly be. I talked a little bit about spins, and I talked a little bit about super radiance, and these are all things that are relevant in this mass scale. So asteroid mass black holes, I think, you know, are very interesting. It's clear that the microlensing constraints are not as strong as we thought they were. And so I think that's a really interesting place to kind of brainstorm and think about how to go after these things. And there's some ideas. We're working on other ideas. For example, you can imagine that these black holes might be captured by pulsar binaries. And in fact, our preliminary estimates say that you should trap a lot of these black holes in sort of, you know, planetary systems that are pulsar binaries. And if that's the case, you might think that, you know, with very accurate radio measurements, you might detect the presence of perturbing bodies around the binaries, maybe. So we've got a team that is working on that. So space cow black holes, again, they can produce dark matter, they can produce a baryon asymmetry, they can leave over Planck relics that we might be able to detect in a variety of ways, but primarily through paleo detectors. So in summary, I think, you know, in this era of gravitational wave astronomy, the physics of macroscopic dark matter candidates, as Jeff also emphasized, offers many opportunities, and there's a lot of space to be, you know, creative and innovative in thinking about how to go after these things. I thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, so questions for Stefano?
So at the very end, you mentioned the CMB as a strong, possibly strong constraint on LIGO range primordial black holes. But I would also say that the LIGO itself sets a strong bound on the possible abundance due to the number of candidates that have been seen, right?
So I don't think so.
Why is that?
There's a little bit of uncertainty. There's a little bit of uncertainty on the binary formation rate for primordial black holes of stellar size, and within that uncertainty, you can largely accommodate 100% of the dark matter being stellar size objects and not overproduce the merger rated LIGO. So that really depends on things like, essentially it only depends on the binary formation rate. That in turn depends on substructure and the mass function of substructures. But generally there's plenty of phase space.
I think that if they are of a single mass, the bound it's at the level of 10 to the minus 3?
Not a stellar mass.
I think it is.
I think not.
I mean, maybe 10 to the minus 2, but for sure not more than that.
Yeah, I don't think so. So the other constraint that there is for LIGO mass black holes is the disruption of structures like, Eridanus 2 and things like that, so global clusters.
But which mechanism are you referring to for the formation of the binaries?
Yeah, so I suggested you read, for example, the paper that I mentioned in one of my slides, the LIGO detect dark matter, and there they have different estimates for the rate.
This is the formation at later times. I'm referring to the formation of binaries early times.
No. That's in that paper.
But we can talk later if you want.
Yes, they study the merger rate across all time.
I think they made an estimate that is not the actual one that says you a stronger bound. I really think so. Yeah. And if you talk to them, they probably will agree with me.
Maybe we can continue the discussion later.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions?
Hi. So you mentioned it in passing, but I will ask just in case. So you mentioned pilot detectors.
Yes.
I agree that if you find a rock that has like no impurities, then nothing went through it. So you can put constraints using them. But if you find some impurity, are we so sure that this has to be some like exotic cosmic particle going through and it did not, it was not, like, do we understand it so well to make sure that any impurity has to be cosmic?
So let me tell you what we did. So the homework we did was, to think about a beta 10 to the negative 3 charged particle that is plowing through matter. Okay, so what does it do? Well, we're talking about a 10 to the 18 GeV particle that, is very slow moving and carries this, electric charge. So it's a very, very slow and very, very ionizing long track that goes on indefinitely. So we think that there are pretty good chances that, you could distinguish that from any other known cosmic ray background. Now, it's going to be an exotic. It's going to be very hard to tell the mass of the particle. It's going to be very hard to tell it apart from other exotics. But I do think that you can beat, if such a track is ever seen in a pilot detector, you can beat, almost any known non-standard type background.
People discuss the bounds of heavy charged particles from mica crystals. The statement was that they simply don't find any penetrating trucks, right? So it's an exclusion limit.
No, but the point is, if there was a detection of such a track, it probably wouldn't have, a known counterpart that could fake it.
More questions? Okay. Actually, I have a couple questions.
Yes.
So one thing is, you mentioned in passing that the PBH formed at radiation-dominated time has spin zero. What about if it's formed at matter domination, early matter domination?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. So there's some theoretical studies that indicate that if you form PBH during matter domination, you would tend to have very large spins. Mm-hmm. And so that is very strongly constrained by LIGO data already. So that's probably you know, it could be used to rule out that class of formation scenarios in some sense. Yeah, yeah, I can send them to you. Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, another question is, so in principle, it seems you could look at the distribution of the PBH along different redshift to distinguish between PBH and the astro black hole.
That's right.
Is there any realistic prospect for this? Or
yeah, people talk about this. People talk about this. They say, you know, maybe if we can, you know, date a merger event as ancient enough that it's not plausible for those black holes to be of astrophysical origin, then yes, that would be another smoking gun, I guess.
What would be the critical redshift for that?
Well, that's not a question for a particle physicist.
Okay.
Given that we don't understand black holes at redshift 7,
yeah.
We would have ruled out quasars if we didn't know they existed, right?
Yeah.
So it's very hard to make that
argument. Yeah, I think people talk about redshifts of, I don't know, 50, 60, 70, something like that. If you saw an event at that insane redshift, then you probably would say, it's hard that it's of astrophysical origin, but who knows?
Any more questions? Yeah.
Can you maybe just talk a little bit more about why it expects evaporation to prefer to build up charge? I guess I'd expect that the only thing that would determine what's being emitted would be the mass of the particles compared to the temperature. So why wouldn't I expect, you know, positrons and electrons to be emitted at the same rate from the black hole?
Yeah, so if the black hole that is evaporating is neutral, in fact, you do evaporate into electrons and positrons democratically. However, you know, if you do evaporate into an electron and the positron goes back inside a black hole, then evidently you charge the black hole, and then it's no longer a democratic process. And then you have a preference to evaporate into same charge particles and so on. So you tend generically to build up a charge by just random walking, right? As a function of the number of steps, you know, you tend to have a net charge. And you can calculate that, and we've done that in quite some detail. So in general, you know, it's not true that. What you can say is, well, okay, then you have this charge, but you can neutralize the charge. And that actually doesn't change anything for the picture that we have in mind, because even if you form this, you know, weird atoms, these are too heavy to be bound by the classic dark matter, you know, charged dark matter constraints on heavy ions. And, you know, you strip the neutralizing electrons very rapidly. And so it's not a problem at all for detection. So the detection story goes through in exactly the same way.
Thanks.
Because physical black holes are all positively charged.
Mm-hmm.
It's irrelevant because the charge is very small.
Yeah.
Matter falls into a black hole, the radiation pressure blows off electrons more easily than
protons,
so it, you know,
that
creates any sizable fraction of any luminosity, then
yeah.
It gets
positive charge, but it's too small to make it. You might actually ask whether the fact that they're charged might lead to extremality and therefore to the end of evaporation because of extremality. But that's kind of shaky territory because you have other processes that can discharge.
So there is a paper by John Silkenfels on that just recently. Have you read it?
On what exactly?
Well, precisely on that, on checking out the...
With extremality, yeah. I mean, the problem is Schwinger pairs. The real problem is Schwinger pairs. So you can discharge through Schwinger pairs quite easily. But of course, you know, we're talking about Planck scale objects, so nobody really knows what's going on. But certainly, you know, we mentioned that in our paper as well. In fact, in my plot, you can see where extremality is, right? This gray band there is where the black hole would be extremal with one electron charge. So, and extremal black holes, of course, don't evaporate because they have zero Hawking temperature.
Given your answer, so you produce an electron positron, the positron falls. Why not the electron falls and the positron comes out?
I mean, yeah, it's fine. It doesn't matter.
So shouldn't that happen democratically?
Yeah, but once it's happened, it's no longer democratic.
It's just a random.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I had a figure. Yeah. We simulated it, and yeah, you know, it goes like square root of n. I mean, it's a trivial random walk type process.
Any more questions? Okay. If no more questions, let's thank Stefano again.